Good morning. Folks, we have an active day today. We're going to start by hearing from our fiscal analyst, Jim Reinholtz, and the reason we're going to do that is we had asked CCA to give him the numbers that they were relying on in landfill cleanup. And I'm interested for the committee to hear two things. What's the outstanding debt for not just the 3M landfill, but all of the landfills out there? How many landfills are still leaking into the groundwater? Are any of them near water sources, drinking water sources? So we have an idea of the obligation of the state going forward. So we're going to hear from Mr. Reinholtz, which Representative Bunn won't be here until later, so then we are going to hear from, we're just very lucky to have Dr. Sean Shetler with us. We're going to hear from him because we have been talking so much about clean energy, and this is just part of our understanding as we move forward on that. And then we're going to hear from Representative Bunn is going to present her amendment. And I think in the, there might be some room for discussion among our fiscal folks between the presentation and our actual move on the bill. So, with that, Mr. Reinholtz.
Madam Chair, members, you should have a blue handout, two-page handout in your today's file that I'll explain what I was trying to show here and hopefully answer your questions on some of it. The first page of it is titled The Closed Landfill Program Expenses, Actual and Projected. And what I did there was I'm taking a much larger piece that the PCA has sent to me that they keep track of by an annual basis of the expenditures of the program. And from day one, 1995, through the current year, and then project out all the way out to 2037. And I've basically collapsed a lot of the columns down and tried to put it in a little different order to give you a different an easier way to set up perspective on the spending for the program. So what I'll review then is how I've done that, and I would say that the first thing is the column titled, and it's spelled actual wrong, it's total actual spending from 95 through fiscal year 07. Since 07 is the most recently completed fiscal year, what this is representing is all the past spending for the program. I combined all the years on the TCA chart into this one column. You can see how it's broken down into the administration, the indirect expenses, reimbursements, and the site costs, which are really what most people would think of as the construction, all the other, that's the reason for the program, the site costs, the other areas are what goes along to make that happen. And you'll see down below that the total is $270.7 million have been spent on this program since it began in 1995. I tried then to sort out where the funding had for the program had come from some other sources at TCA, and you can see down below where I say funding sources, I show remediation funding of 158 and bond funding of 73 for a total of 231. There's some funding missing, and at least at this point, and part of this I've been doing this just in the last day or two, and I have five or six pieces of PCA supplied information, and I'm trying to draw it all into one. And what I found out that was at times the different pieces don't reconcile, and I'm going to have to work with PCA to figure that out. I talked to them a little bit, and they recognize that they have quite a few different documents on this program being produced by different parts of the the agency that don't reconcile. And sometimes there could be explanations just based on difference of timing. They really should be able to reconcile, and I'm going to have to work with them to make sure that I do. The more important area that I really wanted to get to would be what I call the remaining construction period. That would be the fiscal year 08 through 2011, maybe 2012 based on different numbers. And the PCA has testified that they believe on this period of time is when they will have finished all the initial, what they know now of what I would say is initial construction. There will be construction later on for things that have to be renewed. But this cycle would, in their testimony, complete the initial construction. That adds up down, is the column remaining construction, 08 to 011. The total expenses are $93,479,000. I used inflation figures on those totals to come up with, it's actually $100 million if you use 3% inflation between 08 and 08 through 11. So I'm looking at, well, so we need somewhere between $93 million and $100 million to complete what we've been told is the construction, the initial construction over that 4-year period. Now, there also was some problems in this. This piece of all this information for these years and the cost came from PCA, but they handed out some other sheets the other day that had higher construction costs. I chose to keep these ones because these ones were from them and showed the entire program, and that was what I really wanted to do, was be able to have the entire program. But then if you go down below on the 08, 9, 10, 11 era, you see that I put on funding sources to hit that $93 to $100 million depending on inflation. How are we doing to get there? The remediation fund, I went into the fund statement prepared by the PCA for the February forecast and used exactly the numbers they had listed being spent on the program for the next 4 years. That's the 18.849, the 17,769, the 16 million, and the 19 million. That's off of the PCA fund statement. That fund statement shows that the fund can support those expenditures if nothing else in any of the other areas changed, and the fund would be in the black. Now, on the bonding line issue, there was a little question because people have heard, or I think that we have $81 million worth of bonds that have been authorized and are out there right now. What I found, though, at least in the information supplied to me by PCA, was 73.74 of that has actually been used up to 07. They plan in their plan to use $2.539 million in 08. So if there's 81 outstanding, it's just a mathematical calculation that gave me, they have available still 4.721. And the $9 million that I have put in there for 2010 represents the $9 million of bonding that was in the House bonding bill. So this shows available bonding for these 4 years at $16.26 million. The next item is the grant that the PCA has indicated they are going to be getting from 3M. That money showed up in the remediation fund statement for the February forecast and expended in these years, so I put it in those years. And what it's telling me, is there's $96.8 million available, and my spending estimate is shown as between $93,000 and $100,000. So it seems to say that for the next 4-year period of time, there's funding available to do what is outlined on this sheet. The cautions I have to make is I've seen different numbers for prepared by TCA on what kind of site costs and construction costs they want to do over that period of time. And maybe this needs to be worked. I need to work with TCA to be sure that they are in agreement with me. But all these numbers did come from TCA. It's just in various pieces there are different numbers. Then I was going forward. So it would look to me by putting this together that we do have the money to do this over the next 4 years. Which Washington County landfill construction project is in there? I believe it would be the one the agency said they had chosen. It would be the dig and fill on site landfill, not the truck out or the plasma torch. It would be those costs. And so that's a consideration of what projects are in here. And if you look at the post-construction era, I'm labeling that the if we're done construction in fiscal year 11, we've got fiscal year 12 until fiscal year 2020, which is sort of the expenses are renewal of some of the early mitigation efforts, I would say. It's some of it was redoing covers on landfills that had been done early. But mostly it was becoming O&M. You see, the construction is really only $16,000 during that really nine-year period. Post-closure care is $40 million. And so we're really kind of moving into a different era. Now, that one is at 82 to 108, depending on the amount of inflation. And I didn't get the numbers down below because we start moving out where I'm guessing, but if the remediation fund stayed at the same level of the $18 million a year available to the solid waste fund, there would be more than adequate funding purely out of the remediation fund to cover that period of time. And then if you move into a next period of time will be what I've labeled the cliff funded era. And that's the closed landfill investment fund. I'm not sure if all the members are aware that the legislature created a fund back from both. It was some transfers of balances from the solid waste fund and also the insurance recovery money, and has put that into a fund that by statute is not available to use until after fiscal year 2020, and it was. Intended to create enough dollars to take care of the landfill closure activities forever after that 2021. That shows that period of time being $109 million, if not inflated. I inflated it at the 3%, and it shows $198 million. The question of whether or not that fund will have enough money to actually cover those costs is a little difficult when it's so far out. But there is a sheet, your third sheet in that packet, which is an attempt to do that. And I asked the PCA to update. They had done this for me a couple years ago, and I asked them to update it and did get it from them. And what it's attempting to show is we know what the balance in the CLIF fund is right now. I believe it's 40-some million dollars in there right now. If we, in various scenarios of rate of return, this money is invested by the State Board of Investment, just as they handle any other funds sitting in state accounts. The historical growth rate has been 7.29. That's the first column. They used a couple other numbers that shows what happens at different levels of investment return. But the historical rate is probably as good as any to use right now, seeing going forward. If we were making 7.29 in the past, and that's actually kind of a low rate for historically in the stock market anyway, but is about the rate that the State Board of Investment makes, because they're a little bit more conservative unless you tell them to be aggressive. What you see happening is on 2020, it's estimated $139 million will be in that account. In 2021, we start having expenditures out of that account based on what PCA thought the expenditures will be there, and it looks like they had used 3% annual inflation. In one of their notes down below, they say, I believe inflation is in here. And what you notice is the balance goes down the first year, gets down to $113,187.8 as you're looking down. But what happens around 2035 is it starts to stabilize because the expenditures have gone down then. There is very little construction work going on, and it's mostly just monitoring. And if you look all the way to the bottom, really what you see is, because the bold funds are the balance of the fund, that fund, at least at these projections, will be self-sustaining and would go on forever. So saying that the closed landfill investment fund, at least using these assumptions, is doing what the legislator wanted it to do, is covering the cost of those landfills after 2021. So to go back to the front page and where I really started, what I was trying to do was say, do we have, what are these expenditures that we have committed to? And I broke them out into the past, a little bit of the near current, and then the future. And do we have the resources in the pipeline to take care of those things? And the answer appears to be yes. But there's a lot of assumptions there. One is that these construction numbers are what it is going to be. Some actions that are being proposed by members would raise those numbers considerably and would change the dynamic. I'm not sure. There were a lot of conflicting numbers, and I chose to use some of the conservative numbers, I believe, especially on the funding side. So I'm sort of hedging. I didn't have time to talk to PCA beforehand, but I'm assuming that they may tell me that they would think that there are other numbers that maybe are more accurate that they will give me. So I'm giving you some sort of advance notice that we may come back and see something. They're saying that some of the numbers they gave me weren't what they really would call the most accurate ones, and that I may be wanting to change some of those. But to me, it looks like we have the funding with $9 billion worth of bonding as the House had it. For the next 4 years, and this funding out for the out years up till 2037, as long as the legislature is careful on their expenditures out of the remediation fund. That's a good lead-in to the second page here, when I say that as long as the legislature is careful on what they do with those funds, because in the past, relatively short-term history, the legislature and the governor have chosen to basically use environment and remediation funds for reasons other than what it was originally intended to be used for. During those years of shortfalls to the general fund, there were several basically cancellations to the general fund of balances that were in solid waste funds. Most of the funds, Solid Waste Fund, Environmental Fund, Game and Fish Fund, Natural Resources Fund, all funds this committee deal with, usually have balances for various reasons. One is because to balance out over years' time, to be sure that they have, it's good accounting practices to have some backup money in case your forecast is off or revenue changes. The legislature chose, because there was difficult times, and I recommended taking some of those dollars actually because it seemed to solve, it was helping to solve a general fund problem, but it was also at the same time affecting long term this thing. These funds, the environmental fund, you can see in 2003, $11 million was transferred to the general fund. In 2004, $5 million. In 2006, or in 2005, another $5 million was basically transferred. In 2007, $1.37 million was transferred to the general fund. In 2004, $9.9 million came out of MLCAT, which is a metropolitan landfill cleanup fund, and was transferred to the general fund. And at one point, the next item, the Environmental Fund used to get the motor vehicle title transfer fees. And then in 04, that was changed and was sent to the general fund for a while. It's now back in 08 and 09. So there was a significant pool of money for those 4 years that was lost. It's summarized down below, really, $96 million over that 03 to 09 time was pretty much taken out of the either environmental solid waste or remedial fund and used for things other than what it was originally intended to be. I think part of that was those funds had higher income during that period than was projected, so there were excesses available without cutting the programs in this area. But what it's done is reduce the money available in the future. And that's why I said it was a good shift, because I said it looks to me like there's enough remediation fund. If the cost of construction does not grow, and as long as the legislature is careful to use that money for only the cleanup purposes that it was first established for. Madam Chair, I know I'm hedging, and I said that because I really would have. Some of the numbers were clearly conflicting, and I think with more discussion with the CPA, we'll probably get agreement on the numbers. I just didn't have the time to do that.
Well, first of all, I think we just have to. I have to thank Mr. Reinholz for spending all day yesterday working on these numbers, because they were not given to him early in the session. So he just had numbers yesterday to work on. So I think he's done a marvelous job to help us understand what's going on. I really appreciate it. And I'm going to take a few questions, and then we're going to let him have an opportunity to talk to PCA, and then y'all can, PCA can come back and visit with us. But I'm going to take a question first from Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps not a question, but this fund looks fairly large, and if there's some differences in where the dollars are or some confusion on that, perhaps we need a third-party review of that, and the legislative auditor could do a financial review, you know, and maybe have the staff who have the expertise to work with Mr. Reinholz and PCA to go over those numbers and get something to us so we can make a good decision in the future.
Okay. With that, we're going to switch topics for a minute, but we are coming back to this just so you can have a chance to visit with PCA. And I know when I was talking to PCA earlier, they were saying that the Senate proposal to use revenue bonds was perhaps not workable. So, or it would take us into debt, if I get that correct. So I think we need to have some more visiting before we make a decision. So we're going to now invite up someone that I have heard before, Dr. Sean Shetler, who's a senior scientist at the St. Croix Watershed Research Station from the Science Museum of Minnesota. And one of the things is we've been talking about Native Prairie and what it offers to us. He has done some outstanding work on wildlife, for those of you interested in wildlife, and on what seeds, and I can't even describe, frankly, I can't describe this, and we'll let him do it, that we have had a tendency to plant grass seeds because they were the cheapest, and he's going to give us some new insights into how perhaps we should be thinking about the finances of prairie. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. I didn't see that Representative McNamara had a question. Let's just take that question and we're going
to speak. It's back to Mr. Reinholz's presentation. I just want to understand, if I understood what Mr. Reinholz was saying, there's a possibility that we could fund the Washington County landfill project without the addition of additional money other than what's already in our proposal. So are we going to potentially move that bill later today in this meeting And would we be putting a money amount on that? I think it currently has an open appropriation.
Well, we have sent our bonding proposal onto the bonding committee. We've done that, and we recommended $9 million, and he is carrying that in here. We will have discussions, I'm sure, about a triple liner, because we've certainly heard that as one of the proposals, which takes us above this. But I think we need first to have full chat to make sure we're using the right numbers as a base.
Just a quick follow-up. So we potentially would move the bill later yet this morning.
Yes,
we and do. Would we potentially be adding some money onto that bill above the 9?
Potentially. I think that's the discussion this committee has to have. And that we will do after we hear from Dr. Sheldon. Somewhat of a confusing morning, but not really. This is a busy session, and we're so glad to have you here, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and thank you, committee. Can you all hear me fine? And Representative Wagenius, how long would you like me to speak? I can go till noon if you want.
Well, this committee ends at 9:30, and I think it's going to take a few minutes, probably 15, 20 minutes, to discuss what we're going to do in the bonding proposal. I mean, we have made most of the decision there. We're trying to reconcile what we need to do. So it's not that's what we're on. We're on reconciliation.
Half hour, 40 minutes?
Half hour would be great.
Okay.
Okay, with questions, because we'll have questions because there's a lot of interest in biofuels. There's a lot of interest in reconstruction and sequestration.
Right. Thank you. And I apologize. I'm recovering from a cold and doing some field work on the ice, so if I collapse in the middle, just wheel me out and get rid of me. I'll go as fast as I can. There's four parts here, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come, and I think this is actually kind of fun. This is pretty much non-controversial stuff when we're talking about prairies. It's a little like ice cream, you know? Everybody likes it. And what I'm going to try to do is not necessarily tell you anything you might not have already heard, but give you a little different perspective on how to look at prairies, particularly prairies as systems that function and do stuff, and not just a collection of plants. So that's the perspective. And just to review, I'm from the Science Museum of Minnesota. I work at the St. Croix Watershed Research Station, which is the field research station of the Science Museum. And a number of parts of this work were funded by the former LCMR, which is now the LCCMR. So it's a pleasure to do this. Let's see here. Not moving. There we go. Okay, so let's look at prairies. I gotta stand up. What is from the objective of our research? We wanna answer two basic things when we do anything. We wanna create high quality habitat, and generally to create high quality habitat we assume that if we maximize plant diversity, we'll maximize habitat value. We'll talk about that. And the other thing that we do in all of our restorations is we try to preserve the genetic diversity of the lower St. Croix, a 30 or so mile radius around the St. Croix Research Station, to try to preserve the genetic diversity. And I'll talk about that very briefly at the end, why we do that and whether or not we think it's important. And the other question that we always try to come back to is, so what does it matter? Some of what we talk about is expensive and time consuming. Are we really spending our money wisely? And before I go, I will refer frequently to forms in this talk. For those who don't know what forms are, they're generally what you think of as the flower, because there's flowers, forbs, and grasses. Grass is also flower. Grasses are flowering plants, so I can't just say that it's the flower. But when we're talking, and I say forbs, think of the things that you traditionally think of as as the flowers are the forests and grasses are. So another flower class, the grass. Before we get into it, let's establish a reference point. This is an example of what prairies looked like prior to European settlement. This is data from Wisconsin. It's the best data that we have for tall grass prairies. And it presents a commonness index. And a commonness index is exactly what it says. How common is a plant on a particular prairie? It takes into account both how frequently plants occurred on different prairies and then how frequently they occurred within a particular prairie. Multiplies those two numbers together and gives you a commonness index. If we look at this, what do we see? That the most common plants, wild rose, aster, coneflower, goldenrod, aster, which are all forests, they're not grasses. The sixth most common for this mesic prairie is big blue stem of grass. And then more forests, a couple more grasses, and more forests. Prairies were forb rich, highly diverse. They were, in terms of diversity, they were not grass dominated systems, particularly here in the tall grass Midwest. We do not do a very good job of replicating this. Most of our restorations don't include rose. A few of them include smooth aster and coneflower, sometimes goldenrod, never deep aster, hardly ever. Big blue stem, best. Flowering first, hardly ever put in. We don't replicate this. So in terms of authenticity, we don't do a good job in our restoration. And the assumption is that the closer you come to authenticity, the closer you will come to biological function. So how close are we coming in terms of creating good habitat? Now it's difficult to recreate that. Well, plants are there and in their assemblages because they're fit, they can survive, they provide function, and they interact. And so we have to think about plants, not just as these free flowering things, but as how do they function. So how do we think about function? And again, if we think, this is our general assumption, if we maximize diversity, at least at some level, we will improve that function. So we're going to operate that the way to maximize function is to maximize diversity. How do we maximize diversity? Let's think about that. In a prairie, there's a lot of plants, and it's all a battle for that square foot. Who's going to win it? It's competition. And who wins that battle for each square foot depends on a couple of things. If it's a plant, and it's a restoration, it depends on the number of feet per square foot that you plant. If you plan on how many of species A or species B you plant, we'll just take a very simple example here of two species. And it depends on what those species are. This is how I want you now to start thinking about plants. If one of those species, A, we're going to plant 40 feet per square foot, very common amount, we'll plant an equal number of A and B. And if A is big blue stem, 6'4", aggressive, tall, tough plant, and species B is blue-eyed grass, 6 inches tall, it's tough and sweet, but just not that tall. Who's going to win that battle for that square foot if we plant an equal amount? Big blue stem is Muhammad Ali species. Species B, blue-eyed grass, sweet, wonderful, tough species, but it's just not going to compete with Muhammad Ali species. If we planted an equal number of those species, we'd end up with all Muhammad Ali. So we wouldn't have a lot of diversity. So we could just approach our restorations and simply say, okay, we'll plant all B. We'll plant 39 seeds of B and 1 seed of A, and we'll end up with past decline species. There's a problem with that. But there are other aggressive species out there that we didn't want to plant that also come in. These are the Mike Tyson weed species, as I'm using as an example here, knapweed, thistle, parsnip, invasive species. We need the Muhammad Ali species to compete and keep out the weed species. The drawback is planting all a fee is expensive and we need some amount of air. So our hypothesis then was that there is some optimum seeding rate, ratio of competitive to conservative species, the conservative species of those pest decline species, and a planting technique that will maximize our diversity. And we've tested this in a number of experiments where we set up these plots of 10 meter by 10 meter, and now we're actually going larger, and we plant 5 different feeding rates, 10, 20, 40, 60, and 80 feet per square foot, and then different ratios of the grass, competitive to the non-competitive species, 75, 25, 50, 50, and 25, 75. We do all those different combinations, and we find out which of those maximizes our diversity. And one of the things that we've also done in all these experiments, we've planted an equal number of seeds of each species, so that everybody has the same chance to establish. Turns out that's pretty important. I'll skip everything in between, and here's what we found. That as you plant more spore species, you get greater diversity. This is a measure of diversity on this index here. High diversity up here, low diversity down here. You plant more spores, you get higher diversity. When you plant more grass, you don't get higher diversity. It's actually a little different than what we thought it was going to be. We thought there would be some number in here where you planted so many seeds that there was a competition from the other plants themselves that would limit it, and this line would flatten off. And it's going to flatten off, but it flattens off out here. More seeds per square foot max by the first.
Dr. Kirtland, we have a question from Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you, were these all spring seedings, or did you do some fall dormant seeding, or have you, do you have a variable of time of planting?
Yep. Fall seeded, spring seeded, fall seeded, and we also did, in this particular experiment, we did tillage and no tillage. And I won't cover the fall versus spring. There are dramatic differences between fall and spring, but here's the conclusion. They're both good. And they both give you different results. You need some fall and some spring. There's different species and different ones. But we found other things in the study, and that was that here's our study plot, and they don't look like some plantings that we have adjacent to them. We did some just general planting for habitat and seed collection, and these look better. They both were planted with a lot of species. They were both planted with fairly high seeding rates. They were both planted with a very high percentage of forest. How come they look so different? When we have to go in and measure, we determine that the difference is because these are study plots, are weeds, and are as compared to our adjacent restoration. The main difference between them was that in our study plots, we planted an equal number of seeds of each species, but in our general restoration, because we didn't have to do a study, we tended to plant more of some of the cheaper species, like yellow coneflower, bergamot, and black-eyed susan, which are aggressive forest species. We had to ask, was that what's causing this difference? It isn't what we expected. When we go to our study plot, the other thing that we measure then is the density of forest plants. As the density of forest plants goes up, our weed density goes down. You plant more forest seeds, you get more forest. When you get more forest, you get fewer weeds. It's competition. The forest and the ones we want and the ones we planted are forcing out the weeds. So in fact, we can say, and we also went in, because we planted equal number of seeds of each species, we can determine which forbs were growing the most abundant. And it turns out it's yellow coneflower, black-eyed susan, bergamot, easy to establish forbs. Those are the ones that are out competing the weeds. And so we can in fact then say that our non-study plot, our habitat planting, looks better because it has fewer leaves, and fewer leaves has a higher proportion of bergamot, black-eyed susan, yellow coneflower. Our hypothesis was correct. There were some optimum number of competitive and conservative species and seeding rates, but we were wrong about who the aggressive species were. The Muhammad Ali species wasn't big blue cells so much in this case. It was the forest species. The forest species are what are keeping out our leaves. We should have known that, because if we go to a lot of CRP planting, especially those that are dominated by switchgrass, you always have to go in and spray your system. You don't have any forbs to keep out the system. You have only grass. We need those forest species. So in fact, we revised our hypothesis to say not only is there an optimum number of conservative and competitive species, but there's some optimum number of aggressive forest species that we need in here. And I'd like to finally present it at other places. Only in Minnesota do people really know who those guys are. And you guys do know who they are, don't you? The Hansen brothers, and Flashshot, Paul Newman's finest movie. And the other conclusion I didn't cover today, as this data is more coming, is that we also need long-lived species, maintaining diversity and the competition there. Bergamot and black-eyed susan in particular drop out very quickly out of plantings and reduce density, but other species like cup plants and compass plants and indigos fill in over time, and you've got to have those. If you don't have those, you will end up with a
a grass-dominated planting.
And so there's some threshold amount of aggressive forest, longness species, grasses, legumes, all those different niches that we need in order to maximize biodiversity. So the conclusion from this is that really the take-home message here is that different species fall into groups, and those different groups fulfill niches in prairies that create function. And we can't really create function unless we put that diversity in there. And we need all of those things. And there are plenty of people out there who love to kind of divide up the species into what they are. And you get what you plant. The other findings in the study are fairly obvious. You plant more forest seeds, you get greater diversity. We sort of, and this we came up with a rule of thumb that as you increase the forest feeding rate by a factor of 2, you increase your diversity by 50%. That may be unique to our study, but it's a rule of thumb. We need those aggressive forests, and we need competitive feeders. We need diverse feeders. Okay, floristic diversity. So what? Does it really matter? You could argue that diversity is expensive, we've been doing it, we don't have. Do we really need to monkey with all this? One of the main reasons that we do planting is to create habitat. How does diversity affect habitat? It's hard. We know that as with the CRP program, seven numbers and other bird species have bounced back tremendously. So it would seem that just having whatever CRP out there has been good. But could it be better? Is that really good habitat? It's a difficult question to answer because you don't have a controlled experiment. You need side-by-side plots with different levels of diversity and then compare the wildlife value of each of those side-by-side and say which of them are functioning better or differently or how. We don't have those places, except for one. It happens to be in Wisconsin in St. Croix County. But there are now actually a couple of places you can look at this, but this is the first. And by chance, on this site, there were three distinct types of plantings on a 40-acre site planted side by side. There were areas, these tan areas, they were dominated by warm season grasses. Warm season grasses are big blue stem, switchgrass, Indian grass, little blue stem, the typical CRP planting, particularly the first sign-up, major sign-up CRP in 1986. That's what this brown is. Looks like this. Dominated by grass, diversity index 2.8, that's a small number, low diversity. The other was left over on this site by some old pastures that were dominated by brome and Kentucky bluegrass. They're cool season grasses, cool season meaning they grow early in the year, your lawn grows early in the year, and then again in the fall, Kentucky bluegrass is a cool season grass. They're short, they produce a finer thatch. They actually are more diverse because they have, they let in a few more weeds, species in, than the warm season grass. And then scattered throughout this also, we had about half the area planted to mixed prairie high diversity. These were plantings that were done that had greater than 65% forest by rooted abundance. And they have a diversity index of 11, so they're three times more diverse than the other plants. On this site, then, we can compare side-by-side pheasant nesting preferences, songbird nesting preferences, songbird abundances, and small mammal abundances. And this is what the site looks like. Here's the warm season grasses. Here's the diverse planting. Here's the cool season, warm season, diverse, diverse. We have these side-by-side. Excuse me. The other thing that again is we used a new method for inventorying the pheasant nests. We would burn the site in early April and then we would count the nests from the previous year, which we could find real easily like this. And I think this is turned out to be one of the other significant outcomes of this is we were able to inventory this site in about 2 hours, which is very fast. So here's what we found. Here are pheasant nesting attempts from the 3 years we burned, so we can find the nests on the burn year. And these are only nests we're finding. We're not destroying the habitat and hurting the nests of that year. 2002, here's where the nests were. You'll notice that the nests are primarily in the high diversity mixed prairie, a few in the cool season grass, and look at this, there are zero in the warm season grass high diversity. And they have the choice to go here. They're choosing not to go into the warm season grass. Next burn year, same trend. In the high diversity, and a few more in the cool season grass. Right now, in some of our CRPs, we follow up brome grass to plant switchgrass. And finally, last year, a little more even distribution. can communicate, you can see there's a high preference for those diversity plots. And we can summarize it from, in fact, there is a statistical difference between the diverse prairie plantings and the warm season grass. There isn't actually a statistical difference between the diverse prairie and the warm season. When I present this, people walk in and say, well, yeah, that's client data, but I have an 80-acre warm season grass PRP planting, and I see lots of pheasants. And I say, well, what else do you have? Well, I got corn next to it. Pheasants are choosy if given a choice. If we only plant CRP, warm season grass plantings, of course that's where they'll nest. They don't have any choice. What this study is doing is that given a choice, they're choosing to nest in diverse planting as compared to the non-diverse planting. The study does not show that we produce more pheasants in the diverse planting than the warm season. We only assume it. And we can't show that the reproductive success is greater here. But if I was doing planting for pheasant habitat, and I do, I would certainly plant the habitat that those hens are choosing to nest in as compared to the habitat they're not choosing to nest in, because I suspect those hens know something. We also looked at songbirds. The trend is more dramatic for songbirds even than for pheasants. This shows the primary species that we would find on this site, clay-colored sparrows, sedge wrens, and song sparrows. Look at that. They're just concentrated in those high-diversity mixed plantings as compared to either of those grass plants. However, also notice that some species, this one, these sedge wrens, are concentrated in those cool season grass plants. So while diversity is good, and it certainly has some advantages, you wouldn't want to say that diversity just by itself is the answer to plant diversity. There are other things going on in terms of structure and community diversity. And I'm going to illustrate that once more and then sum it up. And again, we show there's a tenfold increase in songbird nesting in the mixed prairie as compared to the grasslands, up to a tenfold. The other thing that we did is we looked at just which songbirds, how many different species of songbirds are using each of the plantings. Again, the mixed prairie, 15 species were observed in the mixed prairie, 9 in each of the cool season grass plantings. You can plot this out again, you see the same thing. Mixed prairie, more songbird species. What is this telling us? More plant prairie species, more bird species. It makes sense. Most of the songbirds, and definitely the pheasants. What are the eating pheasants? And then, well, we'll have to change the weeks here. But pheasants and songbirds, what do the chicks eat for their first, for pheasants, the first 13 weeks of life? They eat insects. They don't eat seeds, they eat insects. So do songbirds. What pollinates grass? When? What pollinates flowers? Insects. It makes sense. You plant high diversity plantings, you get insects, you get birds. And, but again, it's not just plant diversity. Look at that. This tenfold sparrow. This is a threatened species, or a species of concern. The only place it was observed was in the cool season grass. And the bobolinks showed a high preference for the cool season grass. Again, I'll sum that up in a second. The other thing we did is we looked at small mammals. So we would trap small mammals, tag them, and then release them and count how many different species and numbers of times we caught the small mammals and calculate abundance. And here's what we found. We got very different results depending on whether it was a burned or an unburned year. In years where the site was burned, mixed prairie, higher abundance of small mammals as compared to either of the grass plantings. And it was dominated by metal jumping mice. Burned years, switches around. The grasses become more abundant with small mammals, and it switches over to metal mold. This may illustrate the point equally as well as the songbirds do, that it isn't just plant diversity, it's community diversity. There are certain times where the grass community is the preferable mix, either in this case for the metal mold species and unburned years. So while diversity alone is good, we need diversity of community types. We need diversity of diversity. And you may ask, well, why did we look at small mammals? I mean, we don't do prairie restorations to benefit small mammals. Well, small mammals are near the bottom of the food chain. If we affect what happens to small mammals, we have a cascading effect all the way up the food chain. When a fox is trotting through the field looking for a snack, as he supports them, we'd rather have them encounter abundant mice in Gobble-Gobble than encounter a nest and take the egg. So, and this has been shown before on the Delta Marsh for many years with high small mammal reproduction, predation on ground nesting birds go down. So affecting small mammals is too important. And if you have a site that is unburned, in this case, you may be benefited by having grass. So let's summarize this then. How does diversity affect habitat value? Let's review the diversity. First of all, the mixed prairie was 3 times more diverse than either of our grass sites. How did that threefold increase in plant diversity affect habitat? From pheasant nesting, there were 3 times more pheasant nests in the diverse planting than in the warm season grass, which is our typical CFD planting. And there were about 1.5 times more pheasant nests in the cool season. Songbird nesting, up to 10-fold more nests in diverse planting than in either the grass plant. And similar for songbird numbers. 1.5 times more in the mixed prairie than the warm season or the cool season grass. So diversity clearly matters. So not all prairie restorations are created the same. If our objective is habitat, we need to evaluate whether or not it functions. And diversity matters in multiple ways. We need plant diversity. But even if we could make seed mixes that were 100 species, we wouldn't want to take all 100 species, put them all together, and spread it out evenly over the field. If you get one habitat type, then you do that. Both cool season grass plantings were also valuable, even though they were non-native. Right now, we don't do a good job of duplicating a cool season grass plant. And those warm season grass plantings, even though they weren't diverse, they were favorable to some species at some time. We need diversity of community types. Take those 100 species. Put 40 species together here that play well together on recess. Put those there. Take another 40, put those there, and take another 20 and put them here. Now, some of those species can overlap, but don't put all your short species with the tall species. It's mixing the Muhammad Ali's and the Patsy Klein. You don't end up with what you want. You need diversity of community types. Okay, and just to let you know, we've replicated this study down in Moore County, near Austin, Minnesota, with the help of Moore County Pheasants Forever. So that study site that I showed you is an imperfect study site. It's hard to get that data public because of the study site. We get it down here. Each of these plots are 11 acres. They're square. And they have the benefit of the beauty of Moore County. Let me show you that part of Moore County, which is flat, no lake, uniform soil type. It's a perfect study site. And we're going to hopefully start collecting data either this year or next. And we have the same thing, cool season grass, high diversity fall planting, warm season grass. Okay. Then you can counter and say, well, diversity's nice, I believe you on that, but we plant grasses because they are inexpensive and easy to grow. And also, and I won't cover today, small species don't grow. Well, let's look at that. Here's the typical CRP mix. This is provided to me. This is the CP25 mix, used in Minnesota very often. It has at this time, it had a cost per acre of $63 per acre. This would be 8.5 pounds per acre. We would calculate out to be 35 feet per square foot. And in this mix, it's 85% grass based on the numbers of feet. And it's 15% corn. Typical CRP mix, $63 an acre. Okay, we're going to re-examine that mix, but first we're going to talk about whether or not forbs are expensive and what to buy. It's changing, but there's still seed tends to be bought on a per pound basis. Pounds don't mean a lot. A pound of coconut and a pound of mustard seeds are very different. Let's look at it. Big blue stem, 8,200 seeds per ounce cost $5 a pound of seed. That calculates out to be 38 cents for 10,000 seeds. Great blue lobelia, a nice pretty forb, 500,000 seeds per ounce. But it's $300 a pound. So we're not going to put much of that in our mix because it's expensive. Do the math, 38 cents for 10,000 feet. Great blue lobelia and big blue stem are the same price. Yellow coneflower, 45 cents for 10,000 feet. It's basically the same price as big blue stem. Great St. John's wort, cheaper than grass. Culver's root, cheaper than grass. Wool grass, darn near free. An expensive fee would be white indigo. But still we want to put it in because that's a long list fee. So fees are not necessarily expensive if we calculate them based on numbers of seeds. And all good farmers who plant corn and beans, they can tell you exactly the population of seeds planted on their farm. It says right on the back of a bag of seed corn, how many times to plant in order to gain a population of 30,000 corn plants.
Great.
You can do the exact same thing with seeds. So let's do an alternative mix here now, calculating it based on numbers of seeds. Could we, in fact, do diverse mixes for the same price? Well, here's a mix. I'm going to plant more species. I'm going to plant 25 species in this mix that I've made up. Now, this is not a legal CRP mix, but it's going to have 25 species. And here's why it's not legal. It's going to be 86% poor by numbers of seeds. But by weight, it's not. It's by weight, it's, I don't know, not sure what the weight is, but it's not, it doesn't satisfy the CRP requirements. But it's 86% for 25 species, and it's 37 species per square foot. So this is dominated by forests. It must be expensive. $63 an acre. It's the same price as the regular CRP mix, because we're calculating it based on numbers of species. And in fact, I can create a mix. I don't know that I would recommend it, but I can create a mix that is 100% forest, no grass. I'll give you 15% more seeds per square foot, and I'll do it for $60 an acre, whole forest. You could make the argument that forests are actually cheaper than that. I'd like to try this here somewhere just to see how it turns out, but it just illustrates the point. Okay, so then the three-part summary is, we need a variety of species to fill niches. Different species do different things and create functions. As we did greater diversity, we improved our habitat values, but we also showed that we needed both diversity of species and diversity of community types. And finally, it doesn't have to be expensive to do diversity. Very quickly, and I'll summarize because I know this has come up. The last thing is, in all the experiments that we've done, we've used seeds of what we call the St. Croix ecotype. This is all seeds that come from within this roughly 25 to 35 mile radius. We chose this geographic boundary for our seeds. The research station is right there, Wisconsin, Minnesota. Here's Washington County. Not Washington County, but here's Washington County here. Stillwater's about there. We chose this boundary because this was the historic boundary of where the prairie was at the time of European settlement, and then it was separated from other prairie by forest here and forest here. So we said that's why we chose that. There was nothing magical about that particular distance. We said this was connected prairie. All our seed comes from within 25, comes from within that, and all our plantings is between 65 and 90 feet. We are doing this not necessarily because we know if there's anything special about the St. Croix ecotype, because we don't know if there's anything special about the St. Croix ecotype, and because we can't. We took the effort to go out and preserve these genetics, because nobody else is going to preserve the genetics of the St. Croix. We thought it would be good to hedge our bets. And remember that our whole thing in our restorations is based on function. And genetic diversity is a part of function. Plants that are growing on particular sites are adapted to those sites. They're the survivors from all times, all influences coming and going. They carry the genetic coding to be successful. That's part of function. If something changes in climate, or rainfall, or nutrient levels, they can adapt to it. Those are the plants with the fitness for it. So part of function is having the genetic diversity. And that's why we selected those. We aren't sure what they carry, but we know they're successful. What is ecotype? Just very quickly, in case you don't know, it's nothing more than a group of species, a group within a species or adapted to a particular site or particular set of environmental conditions. Blonde-haired, blue-eyed people that say, "Oops, Scott, Willie, and Lena," are ecotypes. That's all it is. And I can give you an example of one. I did a planting for a church, and I purchased seed, and that seed originated from Northern Iowa. This planting is in Washington County. side by side, we had done a restoration where we used fees from New England Aster collected right from within Washington County. The two sites are side by side, same soil, same rainfall, same sunshine. The New England Aster from northern Iowa flowered 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later, than the New England Aster from Washington County. If you're an insect, that's not necessarily a bad thing because you get more pollination time. But New England Aster happens to be the last aster that flowers for the season, and so the New England Aster that flowers late doesn't make any seed because it's hit by the frost. So there are differences, and it can matter. The question you have to ask is, well, first of all, are there differences? And I gave you one. Here's another one. This one's really good for the St. Croix. This is blue rhododendron, but it's white. Along the St. Croix River, about half the populations of all the gentians are white instead of blue. And they survive. They're fit. So clearly there is a difference. The question is distance the best descriptor? I gave an example of blooming kind of New England aster. I can give you another one of seed set timing of cup plants. But there are just as many examples where distance isn't a predictor of differences, but other things. There's examples of ironweed blooming on breadlock prairies. Ironweed supposed to grow on marsh. Purple prairie clover growing on wet sites, supposed to grow on sand. There are sites where I collect New Jersey cheese. Local populations vary from each other and they set seeds at very different times. So the locally adapted populations that are different. If that, so all I would say on these attacks is that if our goal is high quality habitat, we need lots of species. We know that. And we need species that create that variety of mixture. If our goal is to preserve genetics, then we need many populations. We need to identify those sources, but not necessarily restricted by geography. Because we need lots of sites represented, we need to record the location, and again, we need many species. I would ask you, you know, we can preserve the genetic diversity of a species by collecting lots of populations, but is that success? We need lots of species. The common denominator in both of these goals is many species. Get many species. And just a quick acknowledgement to the many graduate students and funding sources that have helped us. Thank you.
Thank you for that great education for me, and I'm hoping there's some folks from the DNR and other agencies who do our restorations in Bowser who do our restorations, and we still hear that geez, that we can only do grasses because it's cheaper.
It's changing.
It's changing, but I'm glad to hear the science that supports the change. So I appreciate it. Any questions for members? We are going to move on to Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the fire. I'm not a chemist, but there's a lot of wide-ranging discussion research going on and the timelines around cellulosic ethanol, liquid ethanol from something other than corn. So it's the enzyme side of it, I guess what somebody's told me it's called. And there's the thermal side of it, which is you take grasses or corn cobs or whatever it is, and you throw it into the gas fire and you burn it, and then you displace your natural gas. And it's been told that the gas fire really doesn't care what you throw in there, it just burns it. But when you make the cellulose ethanol, the number of enzymes you might need to have, if you have a higher diverse number of seeds going in, do we have the enzymes figured out to break down those high numbers of plants or high diverse mixes going into the whatever it's called, the enzymatic cellulose ethanol maker, versus just throwing some switchgrass in and putting some enzymes to it and making some liquid ethanol? I mean, is there, where is that? Because I hear it's ranging, it's like, we can do it, it won't go unless it's completely subsidized, like corn ethanol was in the beginning, or it's 5 to 7 years away and the Department of Energy needs to make it a priority across the whole United States to figure out what's best.
Well,
do you have any perspective on where that is?
I can give you a little bit of my perspective on that, and I'm a chemist, but not that part of chemistry, and so I can't address that exactly. But here's the part I would say is I know they are working on varietal types of switchgrass right now that are probably going to produce a lot of biomass per acre. and will probably compete with diverse plantings in terms of biomass per acre. And in any manufacturing process, it is easier to deal with a uniform in-stock product than a non-uniform one. Both of those things sort of work against the idea of having diverse plant-based communities. But what I would argue, and after having presented this, is that if there are other values to the prairie besides just the energy, and it's how much value we want to put on that in terms of producing pheasants, producing songbirds, producing diverse habitat, and potentially some soil chemistry and carbon sequestration ideas also, that those may be enough to increase the subsidy or whatever necessary in order to get the manufacturing process to use the diverse plants. I don't know. But I don't think that those other benefits should be discounted when talking about energy.
You know what? There are actually lots of questions for you, and I'm getting people coming up and asking, can we spend more time on this? But we can't, just because we do have to do one more thing today. But I think we're going to have to get a way to get some of these questions answered, because folks do have these questions. Good ones. Looking forward. So,
do you want me to come back when you're finished?
No, because we will have to break up and go on to our next piece. But just thank you so much. And we're just going to find a way maybe to have two small conversations about answering the questions that people have.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Representative Bunn has a proposal. We also have reports from PCA, I think, but I think maybe, why don't you go ahead and put yours on the table? I think we have to hear about the numbers.
You want to go ahead?
Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. Today we are starting with House File 3232,
and I will move that bill.
And we have just briefly say one line about this file. This was a bill in order to appropriate bonding, BO bonds, to the remediation of this Washington County landfill. We have with us today, though, a delete all to replace this language. That's A. Do you have a different number? AOH-1156 that you all should have, and we also may have a one number amendment to delete all if that pleases the chair. Madam Chair, do you want to move the delete all so we put the bill in the form we'd like to have it in?
I will move the delete all. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? That motion has been adopted.
And Madam Chair, why don't they go through briefly one line each of the sections of the bill so they understand what it is, and then you can decide if we should amend at this time the one number amendment if you think that's appropriate.
Well, I think maybe just describe instead of going on a fairly technical language.
Yes.
I wish to just describe it because I think we have to hear from Mr. Reinholz again and PCA again of numbers.
Okay. Essentially what this is to, rather than the original proposal, which was for GO bonds, which $9 million, which did go into the bonding request that's currently there on the House side, this one is to, and that was specifically for the Washington County proposal. This is a proposal that was developed with Senate counsel in conjunction with fiscal staff and some conversations with PCA. In addition, late last week, Mr. Reinholz on the House side, Deb Dyson, and others were consulted about this language in this bill. This is a bill to use revenue bonds funded by the remediation fund stream to fund a number of projects. Four, they're listed on page four, and gives the Pollution Control Agency, with approval from Commissioner of Finance, to use the remediation fund to get service revenue bonds And the amount proposed in this bill, which is in section 3 on page 2, number 1B, excuse me, 3B, is $25 million. Embedded in that is an assumption about $15 million, which is the original PCA proposal for Washington County, plus appropriate funds according to the PCA remediation recommended, you know, approaches for three other sites. Those are listed in section 4, part A on page 4. So it's for a number of projects, and it gives them authority to issue bonds up to, not to exceed, $25 million. So that's the gist of this. Revenue bonds would not count. We got opinions on this last week toward the 3% rule for our general bonding bill, and that was a key portion of this. And so that's the gist of this bill. Would you like me to step aside and we'll deal with the others later?
I think we have to hear from Mr. Reinholz. We have to hear from the PCA about numbers. And one of the questions I have right away is, you've included the Albert Lea landfill as a closed landfill site. It's my understanding that that is not a closed landfill site, so we need some clarification from PCA on that. So if Mr. Reinholz, do you want to, while PCA is coming up, do you want to chat with us for a minute?
Madam Chair, members, I did talk to the Senate counsel that drafted the original version of this bill, because originally I had been asked about it and I wasn't certain that it was able to be done with these funds, and my uncertainty was mostly based on the fact that the remediation fund, the prime source of funding there, is the solid waste tax, which is sales tax. That is sales tax, and the Constitution talks about when you use a general tax, that it has to meet some of the constitutional requirements for debt that are beyond this bill. The Senate Council, and they're very good. I have a lot of respect for Senate Council. They have used this format before, and it's been accepted by Bond Council and Sales. And House Research, I'm not a bond expert, as I was asked. House Research bonding people apparently are all right with this, and believe that this is a legal way to go about doing this. So that seems to have been solved, that initial sort of doubt I had. The other item that I think I should point out for you is, as the fiscal analyst of the committee, that how are these being paid back? What this is really, just simply what we're doing is borrowing $25 million to do landfill cleanup in revenue bonds and going to pay it back with the remediation fund. You haven't seen a cash flow on that, but I did a real quick one the other day. It would be about $1.8 million in debt service a year. At what is the likely rate. These are not tax-exempt bonds, is my understanding, so the rate will be a little higher than a GEO bond. That's why they're not part of the bond limits we have. They're not tax-exempt bonds. And so if you look at Subdivision 3, I believe in... It's where the revenue sources, the debt service is payable from the remediation fund, and is really what it's saying. And in fact, there's other language in here that makes that on page 2.3 and 2.4 makes this the priority appropriation from the remediation fund. I'm sure that language is to give comfort to bond houses that these will be paid back by the state by making that a priority. So what it's saying is approximately the first $1.8 million of money in the remediation fund will be used to pay that off. And right now the fund statement prepared by PCA for the Joint Environmental Fund Remediation Fund has a balance at the end of the fourth, this is the fund statement coming out with the February forecast, has basically a balance available of zero in 2011. So we're talking about short of $2 million a year worth of additional funding out of an account that has a zero balance. Now, depending on when they're sold, it might only be 2010, 2011 where that debt service would be paid. But what that would require is at least $2 million worth of reductions, $1.8 million worth of reductions in each of the years from the planned expenditures in the fund statement. The bill doesn't say where those reductions will come from, but in fact leaves it to the commissioner of CPA in the language to figure that out. I don't think it says that anywhere clearly, but in talking to Senate counsel, that is what they assumed would happen. And so the commissioner of the CPA then has basically the authority to figure out how to make that fund balance with these additional expenditures. My guess would be the most likely thing the commissioner would do is he would reduce the expenditures out of the remediation fund as listed for landfill cleanup and replace those with the revenue fund income. And that would work. They could balance the fund doing that. And really what it would be doing is using borrowed money rather than current stream money, and using current stream money for bonds for debt service.
I think I would like to hear from PCA on that, but my question to council is, right now when we saw your earlier figures and it looked like we could pay all but perhaps several million dollars of what needs to be done to get the job done, are you, after you chatted with PCA, are we still on that same track?
We're still on that track. I think that their PCA would maybe say that the gap is a little bit bigger than what I showed, and I think that's because they would probably say that the construction numbers need to be updated, I think would be the primary difference, and they agreed to utilize the format I had presented out here because it shows from day one. Rather than the little, we have little pieces of it that they presented along with their bonding proposal, but I wanted this committee to be able to see from day one. So they're going to take those little pieces and fit them into the total picture. And it'll probably show a slightly bigger gap because I think their estimates of construction are probably larger than what I had. It looks like maybe $7 million more, but and that won't take them very long. I don't mean to speak for them, but they indicated they would probably be able to do that today.
Would you like to tell us about that? Representative Mo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this question is for Mr. Reinholz, and I hate to kind of jump subjects a little bit, but we've had testimony in this committee last year about a Superfund site in Cass Lake, which has a similar grounds, a moral obligation that the responsible party has to cleaning up that site. They're legally fighting the EPA, and the PCA has been loosely involved, was the primary agency involved in the 90s. It would seem to me that it's a very similar situation. Are we setting a precedent here? Is this possibly a road we can go down, or a tool that we can use for other extremely problematic areas around the state? And if so, how would you recommend that an author go about doing that?
Madam Chair, are you talking about the idea of using revenue bonds and to do a lot of construction currently and pay it back? Is that what you're saying,
right,
when you're asking me about a precedent?
Yeah, so creating a, based on the model that Representative Bunn is proposing here for this site, which is obviously needs to be done. There's a far older site that, because of perhaps the lack of population density and income of the residents who live on it, is not getting the same level of public attention. But arguably more polluted, and a very specific responsible party it seems to me that that would be a an opportunity for us to do it, set up a similar circumstance. Is that going to really throw Representative Bunn's proposal out the window here, or is that something that...
The question is maybe that how much revenue bonding can we wisely do, and I mean, as part of that question, that answer is probably beyond me at this point. That putting revenue bonds out does affect the state, you know, rating for bonds. Revenue bonds, that is an item that they do look at, the bond houses. So we don't have unlimited capacity to do revenue bonding. Actually, some of the guidelines in statute are covered by revenue bonding. It's the one that talks about a percentage of it's the state GDP, I believe, or else the income of the state. It's one that we really aren't bumping up to, so people don't normally talk about, but that does include limits on revenue bonds. I think it's also, though, it's the same question that the legislature's been struggling with on Governor Pawlenty's plan to do highways. He wanted to do highways with bonding and pay for them in the future. We've had this proposal to do bonding now for landfills and pay for them in the future. We have bonding bills. That's what the bonding bill does, build buildings and trails and pay for it in the future. That's a larger issue, and one that, you know, I could make a recommendation as a fiscal analyst and say, in my mind, the state should borrow very little money. Why should the entity that's going to be around forever be paying interest? The federal government now is 20-some percent of all revenue in is going out for interest. Where if they didn't do that, they could spend 20% more on programs. But there's always pressure to spend now, and that's what you're doing when you borrow money.
On your issue, I believe there's a responsible party.
Very clear.
And I think the question there is, why has not the responsible party been held to account? And perhaps we need to, instead of proposing bonds for that, have a meeting with TCA and have a hearing on that, why that hasn't been done. Would that be helpful?
I would like to do that, Madam Chair. I think the reason further progress hasn't been made is the responsible party, International Paper, has been willing to spend whatever necessary legally in order to fight the MPCA and EPA to actually do realistic mitigation at that site. They've been able to get away with only vacuuming the carpets of the families who are living in the Superfund site and planting new grass and making sure kids don't play outside.
I think what you are proposing to us is that we have a hearing on that. That's a whole...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Whole big... we're not going to resolve that in 5 minutes, but we would be happy to deal with that later. Before we go down that route, Representative Clark, if we're going to go down that route, because I would like to hear from PCA on their response to our... Mr. Reinholz has offered to work with you to update the figures using the format that he has set up. When can we expect those figures?
Madam Chair, we had a chance to sit down with Mr. Reinholz during the other presentation and identify a couple of problems in the various spreadsheets that we provided to him. Each of those spreadsheets were used for different purposes, and so things didn't always match between them. We do feel there's a discrepancy in our current estimate of construction that's needed that we'll put into the same format as what Mr. Reinholz has put together here, and we'll have that information back to him by early this afternoon.
I think that's critical. So,
I would be remiss, though, if I didn't make sure everybody understood that the site in Cass Lake is a federal Superfund site that's been managed by EPA. But it is an excellent example of exactly why we established the closed landfill program, so that we didn't have the continuing controversies of fighting over what the responsible party has to pay for.
Just to confirm that the MPCA has, as recently, as far as long as I've been in the legislature, very willing to intercede, but there's been some problems with that, not of their making.
This question of the responsible party is what I was going to raise, and I really do think, you know, we know who the responsible party is at the Weston County Landfill. So even though we passed a law that absolves them and anybody else like them who does what they did and covered it up for years and years and years and now want us to bail them out, I just don't think we should sit here and say that we don't know who the responsible party is. And I realize that we have changed the law, and it seems to me like I'm glad we're going to look at the responsible party up at Cass Lake too, but I guess I want some leadership out of the PCA that acknowledges that, and why we have to change the law. I'm sure is because the responsible party in this particular case members wanted it to change, and it's a problem, and it means that we're paying for it. And I just want to put that on the record. I just think that we shouldn't, somehow act like this is there's not a responsible and known party here.
Representative Clark, I think we had a discussion in our last hearing that legally at this point, PCA may not have to put any more money into the landfill fund. However, it is clear, or it seems clear to me, that PCA knew before the landfill program came into being that there were problems and did not let folks know. And so there is a moral obligation, I expect, and I think that's what you're saying, that they have a moral obligation to take care of the mess they created rather than to ask the public to pay for it, which is what's happening right here. I said PCA, I meant 3M. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. Thank you. I have not had my whole cup of coffee this morning, and that's not ever good. I think we need to talk, as I was listening to PCA, and now I'm impressed about that, earlier there was question about the amount of money being suggested to be borrowed and what it would do to your fund, and it would not cash flow. So I think we need to hear from you on that.
Madam Chair, my name is Myrna Hallback, and I'm the budget director for the agency. I have looked at the proposal, and similar to what Mr. Reinholtz has said, is that indeed it leaves a shortfall of about $2 million. It goes up and down. It's not exactly $2 million every year, because depending on how much you sell and where the interest comes back. But the ability that we would have to pay would either be using already borrowed money, and you're paying borrowed. To me, that's a little bit like I pay off one of my credit cards with the check from my other credit card, and so one of them balances a little bit. Eventually, I have to pay them all. One of the other options for that, of course, is to reduce or delay projects, both on the remediation side or shift money from environmental fund. Those are options we're looking at if there is no additional revenue stream coming in. And as the bill is proposed right now, that's what we'd have to do, is look at how we would manage the dollars. But Mr. Reinholtz has explained everything else about the bill exactly as we see it.
What seems to be missing here is the number above and beyond the numbers that Mr. Reinholtz gave us this morning. What the additional construction would be, that's a missing link in this. And so that's one problem. We don't know whether you are anticipating including a triple liner in your projection. That's another problem.
And it's very hard for me to know exactly what to do at this point because we don't have the numbers from the agency. And it's hard to know whether to recommend additional on using the revenue stream or not. We do have a proposal. We're not in a total stuck position right now because the House has a proposal before the bonding committee of $9 million. The Senate has the bonding language. What we can't reconcile at this point because we don't have the numbers and the Senate didn't have them is what that number should be and whether this is the right... And it's hard to in a finance committee to make a recommendation without knowing the numbers. In fact, it's virtually impossible. And we just have not been able to get the numbers quick enough from you.
Madam Chair, the amount of money we would need for the additional liner we had identified before of about an additional $2.5 million, that's not included in the cost estimate that we prepared earlier for any part of our bonding request. As Ms. Hallbeck has said, we don't have any extra money in the remediation fund, in our opinion, and we'll provide the numbers on our projected construction to Mr. Reinholz, and hopefully we can get the spreadsheet to match out. What we really have done in the next 4 years is to try and plan out our proposed construction to match the funds available in the remediation fund. And so we purposely scheduled our future construction work based on the numbers that we felt were coming in.
I'm going to just Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question was whether we were voting today, I'm a little uncomfortable about doing that for a couple of reasons. And one is that I don't know enough about revenue bonds yet, but I noticed that it says that they're exempt from the full faith and credit clause and a variety of other things. So we are kind of opening a whole another can of worms, although I really appreciate Representative Bunn's commitment to try and resolve this issue. But we also haven't I guess I'd like to see what the ultimate resolution is. I talked to one of the owners of, one of the major industrial waste landfills that Representative McNamara was talking about the other day. And, you know, just as the PCA is planning out finances and where the income and the out and the expenses go, they also are looking at the incoming projections for waste into the cells in their landfill, and they have to calculate, the lifetime of that landfill and airspace and existing landfills is quite precious, so we haven't really talked about the logistics of the opportunities we lose with remediating other sites or accommodating industrial waste from existing generators. In this discussion, I guess I'd like to have that discussion about whether we're really going to reduce the amount of industrial waste airspace we have in the state. And then the other one is, this is the kind of crisis where some of these funds are supposed to be used for in the first place, and I don't know if we're going to blow all our wad on this one, or the freeway landfill is one that is concerning to me that was only just newly in the program, and that's going to be, I don't know what we're going to find in that one. So I'm sympathetic with Mr. Lewis's concerns about projecting the stuff that you already know is on the docket, and so we are going to make a dent here in our program, and so I'm not really comfortable voting on this just yet. Thank you.
Representative McNamara and Representative Clark.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be real quick. One question I do have, and Mr. Reinholz or Madam Chair, maybe you know, where we had 9, did the governor have 15 in his recommendation for Washington County?
Yes, he did.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, I had good discussions with Representative Bunn, and I am a co-author on the bill. I signed on it earlier in the week. I'm wondering if, like Representative Gardner said, if we should just stop as far as this. I think we want to keep this bill alive because we need to fix really all 4 of these landfills. And I'm wondering, I like the GO much better than the revenue. And I'm just wondering if we should give time, give this a little bit of time for the different parties to work on it, Madam Chair.
I'm beginning to feel the same way. Representative Clark, mainly because we don't know the numbers, and you cannot, as a finance committee, make a commitment without knowing the numbers. Representative Clark, did you have a question?
Yeah, I do. And maybe this is for Mr. Reynolds. On page 4, lines 4.24, 4.26. If I understand what's happening here, we're giving this new authority for issuing revenue bonds, and we're indicating 4 priorities, and then after that, it's whatever the commissioner would decide. Kind of opening the door here for the commissioner to just say, okay, now that's my next priority, that's the next priority. Right? I mean, there's not oversight by the legislature because of that language beyond those 4. Is that right? And I guess I'm a little uncomfortable with that, considering...
Representative Vaughn, do you want to come up and chat about that? But before you say anything, just to add to Representative Clark's question, I had asked if the Albert Lea landfill was in the closed landfill program.
Madam Chair, there's 2 parts of the Albert Lea that gets a little confusing. There's a separate Edgewater dump that's owned by the city of Albert Lea that there was previous money appropriated in bonding 2 years ago, that there's another request in for additional money that's needed to complete that project. That project would be done in conjunction with some work at the Albert Lea closed landfill, which is about 3/4 of a mile away. There's a need for about $500,000 on the state's part for the work that we need to do at the Albert Lea closed landfill.
I see. All right. That makes sense then, because we appropriated, or we recommended to separately $2.5 million for the other Albert Lea problem. So if there's 2 Albert Lea problems, that makes sense here. Representative Vaughn, do you see our quandary here?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. A couple points to put before you, since some issues have been raised about whether the new corporate, in kind of reverse order to Representative Clark's point, the $25 million figure in there is the figure that is equal to or less than what it would take just to do those 4 sites at the minimal remediation proposal, but the preferred one the agency has put forward. It doesn't include fancy lighters, doesn't include possibly trucking, doesn't include, you know, possibly plasma sources. It's like the basic proposal that they put forward and that the governor bonded for. Number 2, whether it was the GO bond proposal of the agency and the governor, which was $15 million, that would be required debt payment. We would still be borrowing to do these projects. Number 3, it's not clear to me from Mr. Reinhold's figures whether, while there may be a stream there, maybe looking a little more adequate than something, whether any of these projects, this larger size capital project, and this is one of the larger ones, this Washington Hill, could be funded without some kind of bonding, without immediately increasing, since these are taxes to go into that fund, increasing the flow. It's not clear to me that that's even possible without bonding, without greatly increasing the revenue stream from some source, and he might want to address that in a moment. Secondly, over the last 3 weeks of discussion on both the House and Senate side, from both our capital chairs and, at least up to now, from the environment chairs on both sides, the sense was they preferred revenue bonds to GO bonds for this. I won't go into all the reasons, but they are slightly more expensive in certain ways, but in terms of what's appropriate to bond for and how to bond, it actually, you know, from a public finance perspective, this is a very reasonable way to do that, because we have this dedicated stream from solid waste tax, from the insurance, from some various things to provide a debt service for these bonds. So it's capital projects, but you have a stream. Those capital projects take some big chunks, and this is a big chunk, and it's appropriate to bond and then use that stream to pay off that debt. So that makes sense. An additional final point, since I know we have session at 10 or 10:30.
We are going to leave the session in 2 minutes.
Okay, so the initial final point to those of you in the room, the governor has stepped up and the agency to remediate this site starting this summer. The communities of Lake Elmo, Oakdale, and Woodbury, the 60 square miles or so affected by this, expect that kind of action. And if we do not meet or exceed that proposal, it would not look well for us in terms of protecting the public health. And then the final point related to that in terms of delaying action is, and my chair and others will know better than I on this, we are up against, you know, a few days of bonding, final bonding discussions, while there may be added markup to things later, we would like to at least, I would like to at least have, and I'm sure Representative Wells and others from my area, Representative Bollock, to have on the House bonding side at least meet the governor's proposal in some way, if not also leave room for other remediation options, you know, additional better liner or other options that the community may strongly prefer. So those are my closing comments given our time constraints. I leave it to you, Manager Chair, how we should act on this amendment at this time or whether to amend the dollar amount in the amendment.
You have in here $25
million? Correct. And that, like I said, is for the less than or equal to those four projects.
We can do another thing here, and this is what I'm thinking about, that we move this to the Finance Committee, which would be a normal path, without recommendation. Mm-hmm. Because we don't know the number. I think everybody knows that we need to get the job done. I think everybody knows that we are dismayed, or at least that I am dismayed, that 3M is not meeting its moral responsibility here. And we certainly want to protect public health. Unfortunately, we don't have the numbers on which to make a final judgment. Mm-hmm. So what I would recommend, members, is that we pass this without recommendation to the Finance Committee and ask PCA to work with Mr. Reithold immediately so we can see numbers and have them today. Mm-hmm. So we can talk with Finance and talk to Representative Carlson about this mm-hmm. this evening.
Mm-hmm.
So I would
can I make two brief final comments? One is that I appreciate that, Madam Chair. I'm just concerned. I understand that even though this is revenue bonds, it would still have to be in the bonding bill. And just as long as you're aware of that, and I don't know the time schedule for financing the process going forward, how fast that would occur, but we keep that in mind. And secondly, I just want to point out we learned just 2 days ago or so that approximately $90 million, I won't pull it out of my file here, of funds, dollars from the Remediation Fund during the 2003-2007 budget deficit period were removed from this fund, and we would not be in this moving to a deficit position probably if we, from my understanding, if we had the funds that were, you know, intended for this purpose all along but no longer are there.
I don't think we have to worry about the issue of whether the revenue bond proposal is on the table because it came in the Senate bill. What we have to worry about is we don't know the numbers because we haven't gotten good figures from PCA. And so I expect them by this afternoon, and I expect that we know how this cash flows by this afternoon. So with that, members, I would like to renew my motion that this be recommended, or make a motion that this be not recommended passed, just be passed on to Finance as amended and without recommendation. Any question about that procedure? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? That is adopted. This meeting is adjourned.